A day after President Biden defended his decision to pull troops out of Afghanistan, critics are out in force.
The president, sadly, has recreated the same environment we had just before 9/11.
Order has been restored at Kabul's airport. Planes are taking off, some packed, others near empty.
So we were very few people on a big military plane, yes, around 10 people.
Also today, Japan survived the pandemic Olympics. Now that it's over, many Japanese thought it was great.
You also have a large number of people who are still thinking that this was a horrible idea.
And so Japan's prime minister is in hot water. And a flightless bird is making a big comeback in New Zealand. I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Some calm was restored to Kabul's international airport today. A day after a chaotic scene, the runway was cleared of thousands of people desperate to flee Kabul. U.S. forces have taken over air traffic control, allowing more military flights to land and take off. The U.S. and other countries are sending in planes to rescue their citizens and some Afghans who worked with them. France, Italy, Poland, and Spain are among the European nations doing this. Germany, which had the second largest military contingent in Afghanistan behind the U.S., sent in its first plane last night. The World's Lydia Amanalidou spoke with one Afghan who was on board.
Hello? Yeah, this is Abdul.
When I first spoke with Abdul a couple weeks ago, he was in his office in Kabul. At the time, the Taliban had not yet entered the Afghan capital, but the situation in the country was already deteriorating.
To be honest with you, it's a very situation of chaos in Afghanistan these days.
Abdul has family in Australia and in Europe who were urging him to flee the country. Unlike many Afghans, he also has a passport. But he stayed behind because of his work. He was running a small nonprofit helping Afghans who were deported from countries where they were seeking asylum.
So that has been the only cause. The threat level, the risks that I'm facing is out of imagination, to be honest with you.
Abdul felt particularly vulnerable because he worked with foreign governments and journalists and because he's spoken out against the Taliban. This was a few weeks ago. Then, when Taliban militants took over Kabul on Sunday, he decided it was time to flee. When I reached him earlier today...
I'm in a waiting room in Tashkent, Uzbekistan.
I don't have good internet, so bear with me, please.
Abdul is only in Uzbekistan temporarily. Last night, he managed to get on a German military aircraft, the first one Germany sent to evacuate German citizens and Afghan civilians who worked with them. At first, Abdul says the plane couldn't land at the Kabul airport because of the chaos on the tarmac. But eventually, he got on. He says he's not even sure exactly who made that happen.
There were a lot of support for me from Germany, different organizations, individuals, they were involved. Members of parliaments were involved. So, yeah, that's what's happening.
And so then you're told, basically, you're on this next flight.
Yes.
And you went to the airport. What was it like?
Well, it was those setups you only see in movies. People, hundreds of people, thousands even, on the runway. So whenever there's a flight, they want to jump on it, on the wings, up and down. It was difficult. It was a difficult situation. Everyone wanted to get out of the country.
Yeah, and then once you were able to actually board the plane, what was that like? Because I've seen some images of really overcrowded planes taking off from Kabul. What was it like on the plane you were on?
No, it was a different one because they have got control of the airport, so there is more U.S. Marines and Marines from other countries. So they have got control over that. It's no more the case of everyone getting on the plane. And these are only people we have who had come through formal channels. So we were very few people on a big military plane. Yeah, only few of us, around 10 people.
Yeah, and you said formal channels. You know, I know there are many, many people desperately trying to get on one of these planes. And I'm just trying to understand, like, exactly what formal channels did you go through?
I can't really comment on that because I was in an emergency situation and I didn't know which channel is being used to get me out. But again, as I said, There were activists involved. There were organizations involved to get me on a priority list and get out of the country.
I mean, you called this an emergency situation, and I, you know, I didn't even get to ask you yet what that was like for you in Kabul when the Taliban first came in on Sunday.
It was scary. I have never been so scared in my life, because the day that Taliban entered Kabul, I was in my office. I was just going with my normal activities. All of a sudden, at around 11, 11:30, there was rumors that, okay, Taliban is close to this area. And so the best thing we could do is to burn the sensitive documents, ID cards, so there's no identification of our staff for their safety. And then we just closed the office and left for our home.
This is when my line with Abdul dropped and I couldn't reach him again. Before he lost connection, Abdul told me he expected to leave Uzbekistan for Germany this evening. Meanwhile, today, the German government is being criticized for how few people it managed to get on that first plane Abdul was on, just 7 people. German officials say that's because they had to move very quickly, given all the chaos at the airport, and could only take people who were on site ready to go. According to reports, Germany estimates there are up to 10,000 people like Abdul that it needs to evacuate. They include support staff, human rights activists, lawyers, and others believed to be at imminent risk. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
With the Taliban now firmly in control of Afghanistan, the big question remains, how will they actually govern? Today, a Taliban spokesman addressed this at a press conference in Kabul.
We will be witnessing the formation of a strong Islamic and inclusive government.
But what might an Islamic and inclusive government actually look like? Here to help tackle that question is Asfandyar Mir. He's with the Center for International Security at Stanford University. Asfandyar, the Taliban say they want to be inclusive. What has that looked like in the past, and what could it look like in the future?
Look, in the pre-9/11 era, the Taliban ruled with an iron fist. They were exclusionary. They were a highly centralized movement. This time around, the Taliban have come into power, and they're saying that they want to be inclusive. I think they want to include some non-Pashtun ethnicities. They may also bring in some opposition leaders of the Afghan Republic who they've been talking to over the last year or so.
But what about women? Can you imagine the Taliban making room for women in their new government?
Look, the international community has been pressing the Taliban on the rights of women, as well as more general human rights. And the Taliban have acquired this political attribute of performing before the international community. So I expect that they will do certain things on the margins. Obviously, their official line will remain that they are providing rights to women as ordained in Islamic and Sharia law. But still, it would be a fairly regressive regime to when it comes to women. But the Taliban will insist they are providing rights that Islam says women are enjoined to have.
So this kinder, gentler version of the Taliban, you're not convinced?
I'm most certainly not convinced. I think right now people are in fear. So we're not hearing the full reality, what's actually happening on the ground, because people are not talking. They're afraid of the Taliban. So over a period of time, I think we'll learn more as to how they're actually dealing with women in both in the countryside as well as in the major urban centers. I think that might clarify their actual policy and position towards rights of women in society.
I mean, do you see this new Taliban government as having central rule from Kabul and being able to kind of control its people in smaller cities and the countryside? Or is it going to be really a diffuse structure?
No, I expect it to be a highly centralized structure. They believe in unity of command. They believe in matters being decided by a central core group. So in that sense, I think we will see more concentration of power in Kabul and provinces or various regions with ethnic minorities. I think they will not get as many rights as might be envisioned under a decentralized system.
Does the Taliban have any popular support, or do you see it as simply a really tough authoritarian organization that people are simply at their mercy?
You know, whether you support the Taliban is a tough one. Trying to get a true response clearly, there are lots of Afghans who are not okay with the return of the Taliban, which is evident in the numbers that they're trying to leave the country. There is widespread concern among women, activist communities. So there is substantial pushback against the Taliban, no doubt about that.
Asfandyar Mir is with the Center for International Security at Stanford University. He joined us from Palo Alto, California. Thank you so much, Asfandyar.
Thanks for having me.
Now to Haiti, where Tropical Storm Grace is making an already dire humanitarian situation even more difficult. Over the weekend, a magnitude 7.2 earthquake severely damaged several cities in Haiti. The death toll has reached 1,400 people. 7,000 have also been injured, and these numbers are expected to rise. Christy Delafield works in global communications with Mercy Corps, and she joins us now from L'Asile in Haiti. Christy, you arrived in Haiti yesterday and just got to L'Asile this morning, and I know that's closer to the epicenter of the earthquake. What's the situation on the ground there?
It is still very evident, both that the earthquake and the tropical depression Grace passed through. There are rock slides, mud slides, tremendous number of damaged buildings.
Can you describe what you've seen or who you've spoken with since you've got there and what they've been telling you?
Yeah, people are in very, very dire need of shelter. People need clean water. They need food. What we're seeing is just a significant natural disaster here. The emergency conditions are not great, and the fact that this tropical depression moved through is really making it challenging for us to respond. The drive here to L'Asile was over rocky roads. There's, you know, deep, muddy fissures. I think that we drove through about a foot of water at one point in time. Just trying to get to people who are in need. And then everywhere you go, there are folks who are just looking for some assistance.
Christy, what do people need most in the town you're at? What are the most urgent needs that you see?
Well, in the location where I am now in L'Asile, about half of the people have lost their homes completely, and nearly every home has been damaged in some way. So the first thing people are speaking to us about is a need for shelter assistance, so some kinds of tarps or materials to immediately take care of their home or construction materials to rebuild. Additionally, people are really in need of clean water, food, blankets, that kind of thing.
And what is your plan and Mercy Corps' plan of action for the coming days and weeks? What's your specific priority?
Well, our first step is to bring people as much of the sort of essentials as we can. So whether that's clean water, we've got kits coming that have tarps and blankets and other household essentials. But we know that every individual is affected differently and different people have different needs as a result of that. So we'll be shifting as quickly as we can to providing emergency cash assistance. And what this does is it allows the individual families to purchase what they need most and to have that choice to replace what they have lost and support their families in the way that is going to be most helpful for them.
Finally, in terms of the bigger picture, in recent years, Haiti has gone through a lot. Of course, the 2010 earthquake, but also political upheaval, and now this. What's the way forward for Haiti?
Everyone that I'm speaking to has talked about that. It's just crisis after crisis. And you mentioned several of them. I'll add the COVID-19 crisis. Less than 1%, maybe a tenth of 1% of people in Haiti are vaccinated. I think that as in the United States and other countries, we've started to see more widespread access to vaccines. We maybe take it for granted. That's not always an option, and it certainly isn't a widespread option here. They've only just recently started to get vaccines. Generally speaking, what we're looking for is for the international community to really stand up and support Haiti, to learn, to give, to support the response. We know that Haiti has tremendous potential, and we want to support the people here.
Mercy Corps' Christy Delafield talking with us from L'Asile, Haiti, near the epicenter of the recent earthquake. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. American health officials may soon recommend that everyone get a booster shot for COVID-19. That possibility is sparking debates nationally and worldwide. The World's Alana Gordon covers global health for our show and joins us now. Alana, booster shots means in some cases a third shot, even if you've already had two shots. Is that happening anywhere around the globe at this point?
Yeah, for COVID-19, Israel just started a booster shot campaign for people over 50 years old. And that's a main place where people have their eye on because Israel started really early on when vaccines came out, vaccinating its population. here in the U.S., it's been authorized just recently for people who are immunocompromised. And now, just to clarify on this new proposal of a booster for everyone, that's not yet gone through an FDA process or through the main immunization advisory committee. I just want to be clear on that. But what appears to be going on is that scientists in the U.S. are in part looking at data from Israel and what they've been learning there.
And what have they learned?
Scientists I've spoken to have told me that some early data, again, it's very imperfect, that vaccine effectiveness against severe disease appears to wane a bit over time for people who are over the age of 55. And just to be clear, it's unvaccinated people who are far more likely to wind up hospitalized and dying, but that's a piece of information that scientists are looking at.
So are most scientists on board with boosters?
The situation is super tricky right now. There are splits. I talked with Dr. Carlos Del Rio about the U.S. possibility of moving forward with boosters. He's dean and professor at Emory's School of Medicine.
I'm not sure it's what we need to be doing, honestly. And I don't know if doing boosters will make you less likely to be infected with Delta.
I also spoke with Dr. Celine Gounder. She's an infectious disease specialist at NYU and served on Biden's COVID transition task force. She says there's a case to be made for people who are really immunocompromised to get a third shot. But for everyone else, she wants more data. Again, there's a lot of unknowns, though there is something she is really clear about.
You actually optimize individual protection by optimizing community immunity. And to do that, you need to have much more even spread of vaccine across the population.
So the real booster, so to speak, would be doing a better job of vaccinating those who remain unvaccinated.
And so globally, we're still in a place where there's a lot of uneven distribution of vaccines, where lots of the world remains unvaccinated. What's been the global response to the talk of boosters?
From many, it's outrage. The World Health Organization has been calling for a moratorium on all boosters until 10% of the population globally is vaccinated. Dr. Taleng Mofokeng is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Health.
You have large populations of people in the world who have yet to receive a single dose.
She spoke today about this very issue during a press conference, calling attention to the fact that right now, Carol, places like South Africa are not getting access even to the vaccines that are being made in the country. They're going to Europe and the U.S., and now we're talking about more demands because of boosters.
Because it's happening when so many people around the world have already been left out of the vaccine rollout, it would really deepen existing inequities. And in fact, as we always say, if you protect one region of the world, you are just shooting yourself in the foot because those gains will be very short-lived.
And so it's a real bind. You have individual and national interests to protect a population, but that may mean that the virus circulates more in other places, leads to new variants, and potentially puts us all back where we started.
Wow. The world's Alana Gordon. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Carol.
Japanese officials are now gearing up for the Paralympics that kicks off next week and runs through September. But you have to wonder if Japan's Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga is eager to get all of this behind him. He's struggling with an Olympic-sized headache. A large number of Japanese voters are asking, why did you hold these games in the middle of a pandemic? As the World's Patrick Wynn reports, that decision may haunt Prime Minister Suga as he prepares for a rough election.
The Prime Minister had it all figured out. Japanese people who were skeptical about the Olympics would come around once the games got going. In the meantime, his government would push vaccinations hard, causing COVID cases to drop. And by election time in October of this year, the prime minister and his party would sail through.
But that scenario seems to have failed.
Koichi Nakano is a political scholar at Tokyo's Sophia University. He says Japan is now looking at
all kinds of scenarios, including Mr. Suga getting ousted.
Yeah, it's not looking good for Japan's leader. His approval rating is below 30%. That's similar to U.S. President Jimmy Carter in 1979 during the oil crisis. It's close to George W. Bush's rating during the 2008 financial crash. And Suga's undoing may be holding the Olympics during a COVID crisis. Polls show some Japanese people did warm up to the games, about 1 in 3, but Professor Nakano says that is not enough.
You also have a large number of people who are still thinking that this was a horrible idea.
Really worrying Japanese people, though, is COVID. The government says the Olympics have nothing to do with infections going up in recent weeks, mostly in Tokyo. It's a super modern capital with great healthcare, but hospital beds there are running out. People with moderate infections are sometimes told to go home and tough it out. Only about 35% of Japanese people are vaccinated, which is low for a rich country. So now would be the time for Prime Minister Suga to turn on the charm. He's been trying to do that in his news conferences, praising healthcare workers.
Mr. Suga comes across as a very stiff and rather underwhelming speaker who struggles to read his script.
Professor Nakano says this prime minister has never been known as charismatic.
In normal times, that might come across as a sign of, I don't know, sincerity or as a sign of down-to-earth, a common person.
It's certainly not working now. The prime minister is 72, known as a workaholic, more of a background player for much of his career. He was right-hand man to the previous leader, Shinzo Abe, who was close to Donald Trump. His party, even though it's called the Liberal Democratic Party, is right-wing and has mostly dominated Japanese politics since the 50s. To keep dominating, the party may ditch Suga for someone else, like perhaps this veteran politician who, if elected, would be Japan's first female prime minister. That is Sane Takaichi, speaking several years ago at a shrine for fallen Japanese soldiers. She is a hardline nationalist and being considered as a replacement for Suga before the elections. Kind of a risk, though. Her politics can be divisive. Now, with the main party in disarray, seems like a golden opportunity for political challengers to seize the day. But Professor Nakano says,
so far, the opposition parties have yet to profit fully from the change of tide.
The politician leading the main opposition party, which is center-left, got his fame during the Fukushima nuclear meltdown 10 years ago. That would be Yukio Edeno. He was a government spokesman back then, trying to settle people's nerves during that crisis. And he was on TV so much that it became trendy to tweet, "Hey, Edeno, get some sleep." But him winning is a long shot, Koichi Nakano says. Sure, the opposition could emerge victorious.
At this point, it doesn't quite look that way, but it is within the realm of possibility, I guess.
The ruling Liberal Democratic Party is just that sturdy, even when it's wounded. As for Prime Minister Suga, the party will likely decide his fate in late September, meaning he still has about 4 weeks to prove that he should stay on as Japan's leader. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
This is The World. Cambodia's Khmer Rouge leadership has been on trial for more than 2 decades. The tribunals designed to help Cambodia heal are now ending, but many wounds remain.
I don't think many of the Cambodian population and Cambodian people had the privilege to focus on closure and justice.
That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. President Biden says he stands squarely behind his decision to exit Afghanistan. But many with deep experience in the region are harshly critical of what the president did and warn of blowback.
People around the world are watching what we do and what we say. They are saying, boy, do not partner up with the Americans. Do not count on the Americans. They won't be there in the end, and they will blame it all on you.
That's Ryan Crocker. He served as U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan under President Obama. I asked him what he made of the Taliban's announcement today of a nationwide amnesty and a call for women to join the government.
Okay, they've said these pretty things. Let's see what happens on the ground. Let's see if they facilitate the evacuation of those who want to get out and not risk their lives under Taliban rule. The Taliban has all the agency here. We gave ours up. We gave it up to them. So we don't really decide anything anymore of a security nature. They will decide what they want to do, and we will have to react depending on what that is.
Yesterday, President Biden put much of the blame for the chaos of the moment at the feet of the Afghan government and its people. Let's listen.
Afghanistan political leaders gave up and fled the country. The Afghan military collapsed, sometime without trying to fight. If anything, the developments of the past week reinforced that ending U.S. military involvement in Afghanistan now was the right decision. American troops cannot and should not be fighting in a war and dying in a war that Afghan forces are not willing to fight for themselves.
President Biden is really pointing a finger at the Afghans, saying they wouldn't stand up and fight for their country. Is that fair?
Carol, that is just appalling. Back when I was ambassador, once a week over at the International Security Force compound, there'd be a brief memorial service to commemorate those who had died in the previous week. And, you know, it was a wrenching ceremony. There would be always, sadly, some American troopers and a few others from other allies. Their names would be read. And then the Afghan military representative would stand up. He didn't read any names. He gave a number, you know, 123 last week, 165 this week. And so it went. So for the president to say that this is on the Afghan security forces who refused to fight, they have been fighting and dying for their country in unbelievable numbers for more than a decade now. So, Mr. President, you used the phrase, the buck stops here. You tried to put that on the Afghan security forces. No, sir, the buck stops on your desk.
What specifically do you think President Biden could have done differently to avoid the crisis we're seeing right now?
He could have not taken a rush to the exits. Look, when I was in Kabul as ambassador, 2011-2012, it was the peak of the surge. We were up to almost 100,000 troopers on the ground in Afghanistan. There was violence from the Taliban, but they didn't hold any provincial capitals. We steadily drew down our numbers, and then President Trump cut further. And what happened? Well, the Taliban still did not hold any provincial capitals. We were at a status quo point that was not great, but it was workable. There are some problems out there that can't be fixed. They have to be managed. And I would put Afghanistan into that category. We're not going to transform it into the shining city on the hill. But we could and did demonstrate that with a really minimal number of troops that were not directly involved in combat operations, that the Afghans could get by. The only thing that changed was the Biden decision. That is what pulled the plug on all of this. And then the way it was done has given us what we've seen, those awful images out of Kabul airport. So bad policy decision, bad policy execution. He got both.
Do you think that President Biden should have involved the Afghan government? I mean, he continued the Trump policy of negotiating with only the Taliban.
That, of course, was the beginning of this extended train wreck. Caving into that longstanding Taliban demand meant that these were not, never would be, peace negotiations. They were surrender talks. And I was frankly stunned to see President Biden embrace that policy, embrace the Afghan envoy that President Trump had been using, and actually pull the plug. I think of all the body blows the Afghan government and its security forces suffered, we administered the most powerful punches against them, our ostensible ally.
I want to get back to what the U.S. mission in Afghanistan was. Yesterday, President Biden described it quite narrowly. Here's what he said.
Our mission in Afghanistan was never supposed to have been nation building. It was never supposed to be creating a unified, centralized democracy. Our only vital national interest in Afghanistan remains today what it has always been, preventing a terrorist attack on America's homeland.
Ambassador Crocker, you were there in 2002, one of the U.S. diplomats arriving in Kabul to reopen the shuttered U.S. embassy after the Taliban was routed. What was the mission from the get-go?
It was about ensuring America's security, to ensure that Afghan soil would never again be used to plan strikes into the United States of America itself. And over a period of almost 20 years, I think we did a pretty good job on that. Now all that is at risk because of the president's decisions. What do I mean? Well, the Taliban is back. There they are, roaming the streets of all 34 provincial capitals now. This is not a kinder and gentler Taliban. These guys are hardened, tough, ruthless. In other words, they're the guys that brought us 9/11 by sheltering al-Qaeda, and they're back. Al-Qaeda will be back with them. So the president, sadly, has recreated the same environment we had just before 9/11. So the president has really put the band back together. This particular band, of course, attacked our country.
At this point, Is there anything the Biden administration can do to make the immediate situation in Afghanistan better? I mean, if you had the president's ear, what would you tell him to do right now, today?
I would tell him to do what, to give them credit, the administration is actually doing. Bringing in aircraft, getting obviously our own folks out, but also getting out those tens of thousands of Afghans who risk their lives to support our efforts. Just get people out. We're all full of recriminations. We're all pointing our fingers at everybody else. Yeah, that's going to go on. That's part of the process. But right now, it's about individual lives.
Ambassador Crocker, are you in touch with Afghans on the ground?
I am. And it is wrenching beyond description, Carol. Like many, many other Americans who served in Afghanistan, we are getting a lot of desperate messages. And it's just gut-wrenching to read these texts and emails that say, please don't forget me. The Taliban are here. They're going to kill me. Please get me out. It's very, very painful.
Ryan Crocker spent 40 years in the Foreign Service. He served as U.S. Ambassador to Afghanistan under President Obama. Thanks, Ambassador Crocker.
Thank you.
President Biden's address yesterday is also getting some blowback from British lawmakers. Conservative MP Simon Clark described Biden's speech as grotesque. More than 150,000 British soldiers have served in Afghanistan. Last month, Prime Minister Boris Johnson said they're coming home. From London, the world's Orla Barry reports on the response and political fallout in the UK.
Andrew Fox served three tours of duty in Afghanistan with the British Army between 2007 and 2010. On his third stint in Helmand and Kandahar provinces, he worked alongside US forces.
It was an extremely arduous period. We were targeting Taliban commanders and Taliban improvised explosive device, IED facilitators. So we were doing very different kind of missions where we'd fly in helicopters at night and raid compounds to kill or capture, you know, high-end Taliban targets.
But the former army major tells me this was also the first time he really felt like he was doing something worthwhile in Afghanistan.
You know, for every IED facilitator we removed from the ground, that was life saved because they wouldn't be planting bombs in the ground to go and attack the ground holding groups. So for the first two tours, I would say it felt a little bit futile. But on that third tour, I did feel like I was making a difference.
As Fox watches what's happening in Afghanistan today, he says he now wonders if their service was worth it.
It's been a really tough week for people that served in Afghanistan. One of my best mates, Matt, said to me, you know, it feels like that the defining event of our adult lives turned out to be a waste of time. And I find that very hard to disagree with in many ways.
Andrew Fox isn't alone in his sense of disillusionment. Lawmakers from all political parties in Britain have questioned why the UK and the US pulled their forces out of Afghanistan so quickly. Tom Tugendhat, an MP with the ruling Conservative Party, told the BBC that the US and its allies have simply deserted Afghans.
10,000 NATO soldiers were maintaining a force of some 400,000 Afghan troops. But as we left, we stripped them effectively of their combat power and convinced them that there was no tomorrow. And in doing so, we abandoned the Afghan people. And this is the result.
For Tugendhat, it's personal. He served as an army officer in Afghanistan for 4 years, and he says he feels a deep connection with the country. Rory Stewart understands that feeling. Stewart, who's a former Conservative MP, spent time there 20 years ago.
I walked across the country in the winter of 2001-2002 alone, but I wasn't alone in a sense because Afghans always came with me from village to village, kept me alive from one side of the country to another when there was no government, showed me immense generosity and hospitality, taking me into their houses night after night.
Stewart says Britain and other NATO countries should have stayed in Afghanistan even after the US pulled out. Boris Johnson didn't have to follow President Biden's lead, he says. But it's Biden that Stewart is most angry with.
I think it's very, very sad that when he had an opportunity to prove in Afghanistan a moderate, patient American approach, he threw that chance away and he's aped Donald Trump's stance, hoping that this will benefit him in the midterms. And he's done it with an extraordinary callousness and lack of imagination and empathy.
Today, the British Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, refused to criticise Joe Biden. Raab announced a new resettlement scheme for Afghan refugees, but he wouldn't say how many would be eligible for it. A few thousand Afghan interpreters and their families have already resettled in Britain. One of those interpreters spoke to me this afternoon from Birmingham. He doesn't want me to say his name because he's afraid his family, who are still in Kabul, could be targeted.
I know everybody's in danger, everybody's panicking, but my family is in danger because of the British government. I have worked for the British forces. I have been injured with the British forces. I have 160 stitches in a war which was sold to me in the name of war against terror.
He's now a British citizen, but no one from his family have been allowed to join him in the UK so far, and relatives in Kabul have warned his parents to flee before the Taliban finds them.
And they particularly told my dad that move out of this home, go anywhere. If you cannot go abroad, go anywhere just to get out of your home, because they will come after you. My parents are right now not in their own homes. They are in other places hiding.
There's a protest planned for tomorrow outside the British Parliament, calling on MPs to do more for Afghan refugees. Lawmakers are ending their summer break early to attend an emergency session of Parliament. The Afghan interpreter tells me he plans to be at the protest in London, and he has this message for British MPs.
I have saved a number of British soldiers' lives. Today, my family needs me to save their lives. So I want everybody to do the same that I have done for them. Save my family, save my parents, save my siblings.
British officials in Afghanistan say they hope to help up to 7,000 people to leave the country in the coming days. The military commander in charge of the evacuation mission in Kabul said this afternoon that the Taliban are not interfering with what UK forces are trying to do. At least not yet. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
Before much of the world realized what was playing out in Afghanistan, the government of China was already making overtures to the Taliban. Those are cameras snapping away in Tianjin, China. The Chinese foreign minister hosted a delegation of Taliban leaders there in late July. The World's China correspondent, Rebecca Canther, is on the line from Shanghai. What's going on here, Rebecca? What is China's official relationship with the Taliban?
Well, when you look at those pictures from the meeting last month, it all looks warm and rosy, but actually it's a complicated relationship. When the Taliban took over Afghanistan back in the 90s, the last time, China saw this group as a threat, and it closed the Chinese embassy in Kabul and cut off official relations. This time, the embassy remains open, and Beijing is signaling it has different priorities. I talked about this with Chen Daoying. He's a political analyst and a former professor at Shanghai University of Political Science and Law. So China is saying that China has mixed feelings towards the Taliban. On the one hand, it's recognizing the group as it takes control of Afghanistan, but Beijing is also drawing a line in the sand, he says, when it comes to security and terrorism. So the point here is, Carol, that China shares a border about 50 miles long with Afghanistan, and it's very concerned about Islamic extremism and terrorism sort of spilling over into Western China and affecting the situation in Xinjiang.
But beyond the issue of security, why is China building bridges with the Taliban right now?
So an overly simple answer, but it's for economic reasons. Here's Valina Chakarova. She's the director of the Austrian Institute for Europe and International Security.
Currently, China is Afghanistan's second largest trading partner, and there is a lot of space, you know, to actually increase the trade volume and to invest more.
So she's referring to China's Belt and Road Initiative. That's a massive long-term infrastructure effort that China's financing across Asia. And Beijing sees opportunity here to make Afghanistan part of it. I mean, they're building roads, bridges, railways, power plants, that sort of thing. But also, Afghanistan has large stores of rare earth and minerals, and that is very valuable to China.
So is China's interest in Afghanistan an economic one, or is it also trying to possibly fill the void that the U.S. is leaving?
I asked Valina Chakarova about that. She says China is going to proceed with caution. So Beijing is very unlikely to intervene militarily, at least in the same way that the U.S. has done, she said. But she says that could change down the road.
I would not exclude a scenario of Chinese boots on the ground at some point of time, but not now and not in a few months.
Final question, Rebecca. What are you seeing in terms of opinions in China about what's playing out right now in Afghanistan? I mean, how are people there talking about it?
Well, the Chinese internet is always full of nationalist sentiment, and so there's a lot of gloating going on. People are taking some pleasure in pointing out what they see as a huge American failure in Afghanistan. Then you've got Chinese state media sort of making hints about Taiwan, hinting that U.S. support for Taiwan would not be strong if Beijing decided to go in. And then lastly, I see people, you know, regular people just expressing their disdain for the Taliban because of how they've treated women and their extremist views. There's a lot of empathy for what the Afghans are going through right now.
The World's China correspondent, Rebecca Kanther, speaking to us from Shanghai. Thanks a lot, Rebecca.
Thank you.
In Cambodia, the last living member of the Khmer Rouge regime's leadership took the stand today. 90-year-old Khieu Samphan was the former head of state in the 1970s. He's now attempting to overturn genocide charges that he was previously convicted of. The Khmer Rouge Tribunal was established in 1997 by the Cambodian government and the United Nations. As its mission comes to a close, reporter Ashley Westerman reports that the legacy of the tribunal is mixed.
There's a saying in Cambodia that its population is split into two groups, the survivors of the Khmer Rouge regime and their children. Yuk Chang is both.
I was a young teenager, age of 13. So I do remember, but not every detail, but I remember a lot.
Chang remembers in 1975 when the Communist Party of Kampuchea, known as the Khmer Rouge, took control, locking down cities and forcing people out of their homes. His family ended up fleeing the country, but not without heavy costs. Chang lost his father, some sisters, uncles, and cousins.
It's been broken, you know, it's a broken family, not just only our family, but for the entire Cambodia.
Some 2 million Cambodians died during the totalitarian rule of the Khmer Rouge, about 25% of the country. So when a judicial body was established in the late 90s with the goal of putting Khmer Rouge leaders on trial, Chang says the Cambodian people were on board.
I think that people also give justice a chance. They want people to recognize the suffering that they have been through. So the tribunal was the answer.
Chung is now the executive director of the Documentation Center of Cambodia, which possesses the largest archive on the Khmer Rouge period and has helped the tribunal build its cases against the perpetrators. Early surveys showed that the tribunal had overwhelming support. Chung says public participation was key.
You know, there's a sense of ownership of history, but also it brings some closure, also brings some frustration.
Frustrations that experts say have eroded the view of the tribunal over time. These frustrations range from constant financial troubles to alleged meddling by the Cambodian government. Prime Minister Hun Sen is a former Khmer Rouge commander and has openly never been a fan of the tribunal. Varak U is a human rights activist based in Phnom Penh who lost his father during the Khmer Rouge regime.
It feels to be too political, not a proper tribunal in a sense, just because there's too much compromise. But I think for the first conviction and the second conviction, I thought there was some sense of justice being done.
Still, it took a while to get there, highlighting another frustration with the tribunal, its glacial pace. It took nearly 10 years just to set up the body itself, which is made up of both domestic and international judges. And by the time hearings began in the late aughts, Wu says, to the Cambodian eye, the defendants looked like grandparents.
So it was very difficult to connect the level of brutality of the alleged crime to the people who's supposed to stand trial.
The tribunal's first conviction didn't come until 2010. Kinguk Uv, commonly known as Commander Duch, was sentenced to life in prison on a slew of charges, including crimes against humanity, murder, and torture. Here he is, in his 60s, giving a statement to the court in 2009. I am determined to take legal and moral responsibilities for the crimes committed at S21, he said at the time, referring to the notorious Tuol Sleng prison. Longtime journalist May Tatara recalls going to Duch's village, where he was known as a teacher.
But when they saw him in front of TV, they were so surprised. They said, "Oh, my friend, I could not believe that you are the chief of the prisoner of S21.
Duch died in prison last year. He was one of only a handful to be convicted by the tribunal. Meanwhile, Pol Pot, the infamous Khmer Rouge leader, was actually never tried. He died in 1997. May says that while the tribunal was once very important to the older generation, many Cambodians now have other things on their mind, like widespread poverty and the pandemic. Varak U agrees with that sentiment. He says ultimately, the tribunal cannot fix many of the problems the country continues to deal with.
So because of that, I don't think many of the Cambodian population and Cambodian people had the privilege to focus on closure and justice and a process that, that could be dragging on for months, if not years.
Experts also say the ending of the tribunal may have wider geopolitical implications. Josh Kurtlandzik is with the Council on Foreign Affairs. He says China, which was a huge backer of the Khmer Rouge and had a close relationship with Pol Pot, is likely thrilled that it's almost over.
They don't want stories widely circulating of China backing, you know, one of the probably after the Nazis, one of the most brutal regimes in world history.
He says even though China is Cambodia's biggest investor, Beijing is acutely aware of the rising anti-Chinese sentiment in Southeast Asia. For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman.
Some good news coming out of New Zealand this week. The flightless kiwi bird is only found in New Zealand, and it is now flourishing and moving into previously deserted areas. That's a female kiwi celebrating, I think. Every 5 years, a conservation group called Kiwi Coast places acoustic monitoring devices in the wild to see if they can record any kiwi calls. This year, they detected kiwis in 50% of the sites that were silent back in 2016. So expect a whole lot more of this. That's a male kiwi call. The survey also found that kiwis aren't just spreading out. Their overall population is growing. For example, there are now more than 1,000 of the iconic New Zealand birds in the Whangarei Heads area on the coast of the North Island. That's up from just 80 kiwi 20 years ago, which is an increase of more than 1,000%. The conservation group Kiwi Coast is thrilled and surprised by all this. They thought it would take longer to restore what was a dwindling population. This rise in kiwis shows that conservation efforts to control predators like dogs and ferrets are working. But the nocturnal birds get some credit here, too. They have a high breeding rate. The more, the merrier. Stay with The World for ongoing coverage of the events in Afghanistan and the repercussions being felt across the globe. Members of the U.S. military have especially deep connections to Afghanistan. Tomorrow, we'll bring you a story about how members of the special forces worked with Afghan soldiers and their perspective on what's happening now. Head over to theworld.org for more of our reporting on the Taliban's return to power in Afghanistan. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. We'll be back with you tomorrow. From PRX.